What is it, Major Lawrence, that attracts you personally to the desert?
It's clean.
The toughest race on Earth takes you across the Sahara Desert as you do 5.5 back-to-back marathons in one of the most inhospitable places on Earth. You'd expect the theme tune to be of Lawrence of Arabia, but this is the real truth. Mark Middlemass is the Director of Communications at software company Radium 1 and has just returned from the 2016 Marathon des Sables. He's quizzed by friend Andy Corcoran, a managing partner at Universal McCann. He did the race in 2008. They chat about what it's like to do the grueling experience and why Mark did the race in aid of charity, Walking with the Wounded.
So, first of all, what is the Marathon des Sables?
The Marathon des Sables, as I understand it, Corkers, is an ultra-marathon, 155 miles long across the Sahara Desert.
And it's self-sufficient?
Self-sufficiency plays a very big part in it, which ultimately means that you carry your own equipment, your own food, your own cooking gear, your own sleeping equipment, your own cleaning stuff. There's no showers, there's nothing, there's no toilets apart from a seat and a load of brown bags that you use for depositing waste.
And do you carry your own water? Or
you get given water every day at all the various checkpoints at the start of every day. You know, there's a grand fanfare where everyone rushes with their water cards to the truck. And that's one of the steppings into the unknown. You know, you can train for it, but you can't really train for just getting dumped with a load of water in the Sahara.
The London Marathon's only, you know, a couple of weekends ago, and you've got so many people raising extraordinary amounts of money for charity. So Marathon des Sables is the most, it's the world's toughest foot race, as Discovery Channel calls it. Yeah. Why do this one?
Couple of reasons. I'd always wanted to do the Marathon des Sables. When we lived in Zimbabwe back in the late 80s, my dad, who was out there with the British Army, we met an absolute nutcase who used to run a marathon before breakfast every day. He was called Colonel Lionel Dyke, and he was the last white officer in the Zimbabwean Army. He used to take pet lions on parade with him so his soldiers behaved.
Damn.
And he'd done this numerous times. So that planted the seed, but it came to fruition, and all the, you know, in a sad way. I lost both my parents in a very short space of time, around about 18 months ago. My mum went first for a very long illness, and dad lost the love of his life, so he smoked himself to death, effectively. Mm-hmm. And then my partner and child left shortly afterwards. So, you know, this triumvirate of, you know, pretty crap news made me feel very sorry for myself. I was at an all-time low in life. I was drinking far too much. And one Saturday evening, I was sitting on the sofa, scanning through Twitter as you do, bored out of my mind, you know, another glass in hand, when I spotted something from Walking with the Wounded, which is a charity I know very well. I know the people who've founded it. And mum and dad were big supporters of. And it said, interested in a challenge, the Marathon des Sables, fancy a place. And something, you know, life's funny when it throws a lot of rubbish at you. But at that moment, this spark went off in my mind. Mm-hmm. And I knew there was my purpose. There was a chance to get back on my feet for something I really believed in.
And so from sign up, from that tweet, how long was it then until the start line? What was the...
I mean, you're looking at pretty much a year and a bit. So I think it was around about, well, it might have been even a bang on a year. It was April. It was raining, you know, good old April showers were out there. I think Liverpool had just lost another game. You know, the end of Brendan's reign, if you like. You know, I was still disappointed from almost winning the title that Leicester have recently brilliantly won. And, you know, I said to Ed, I emailed him straight away, and he came back to me on Monday. He'd had a chat. Ed is the co-founder of Walking with the Wounded. And he said, Mids, we know you, you're in. He, unbeknownst to me, had phoned Dags and asked for from his advice. And Dags, Simon Dagleish at ITV, said to me, said to Ed, you know, Mids is a good lad, you know, put him on the team. So I, from then on, I was on the team. You know, the journey began. I'll be honest, I was, you know, I wasn't quite sure what I'd let myself in for. But I knew with that focus that you talked about and a purpose, which was to finish the Marathon des Sables, yeah. something came over me, which gave me that purpose and that focus and that vision to get to the finish line, really.
The year you mentioned, near enough from signing up to the start line, I certainly know a good handful, maybe more, of people who train for that long for the London Marathon. So what level of fitness did you start at?
I was, I would say I was at a mixed level of fitness. I've always been very athletic. You know, Dad was a huge cross-country runner. I wasn't bad myself. But media does funny things to the human body. And I've always been quite thin and quite, you know, sort of, you know, broad shoulders, I think someone once called it. But media lunches can sort of play havoc with your fitness. And I knew I had to get up to a base level fairly sharp because I'd lost a bit of my competitive edge.
Or when faced with a 150-mile self-sufficient marathon through the Sahara Desert, you mean?
Exactly right. So yeah. I spent the first couple of months getting up to speed, just getting my... When my engine...
How do you start? How do you start training?
I mean, it's a good question. I've always enjoyed running. So what I did was, and I took some advice from people who'd who'd done some marathon running before, and they said, look, just do a few 10Ks.
Yeah.
So I started with 10Ks, and I live in a beautiful area in Surrey near Hankley Common, which is where the army train, and it's ideal for, you know, running, trekking, hiking type thing. And I just did probably 9 or 10 of those, got those under my belt over a, you know, I wasn't stupid, I didn't do them on the bounce every day.
Yeah.
But until I felt that my body was ready, I didn't switch off alcohol. I didn't switch off, you know, good eating, but I slowly trained myself into it. And I got myself into a place where I was very comfortable with exercise. And I gradually built up.
So can you just tell me a little bit about your heat training in your house?
Right. So I did two elements of heat training, and I to replicate the conditions of around about 40 to 45 degrees in the
and
Sahara.
Obviously, you bought 40 tons of sand and dumped them inside the house.
All that sort of thing. It was a proper children's playground. But no, I bought a running machine, and I had it placed in the living room, in the house in Surrey, and then I would turn the heating on full blast and shut the door, so to get that temperature up as much as possible. The running machine would be on generating further heat. I'd have a thermometer on the side.
Really?
And I would run for anywhere between 3 and 4 hours. You know, with my... I had a backpack on to replicate the food I'd have in there that I'd yet to buy.
How heavy was the backpack?
The backpack was around 15 to 17 kgs.
Okay.
At the time, I didn't know. It just felt heavy because I didn't measure it. I thought, sod it. You know, I'm reasonably strong, so I'll just get through it. I only found out afterwards when I had my full backpack that it felt a lot lighter than what I trained with. So that was good mentally, really important actually, that I didn't feel too bad on the start line.
Train hard, fight easy, yeah?
That's what they say.
Well, so at what point in your training do you start doing those 3 to 4 hour runs? Because that sounds extreme even to me. Got the heat up in your house, it's probably what,
35 plus to 45 degrees on a good day.
For 3 or 4 hours. So from your sign up to getting there, what was the kind of timing?
I mean, I only bought the running machine 6 months in.
Okay.
So
you'd done a fair bit of running before.
Yeah. And I felt comfortable. I felt natural. The legs and the body and the lungs were going well. The equipment, you know, the trainers and that stuff, the weather was crap. So that was a bit frustrating, which gave me the impetus to buy a running machine, because I knew, even though I'd grown up in places like Cyprus and Zimbabwe where the heat was nothing, and it was good actually, because I could feel it in Morocco being similar conditions, which gave me all-round confidence. I knew that I had to get something under my belt, and it just that confidence thing, so important, as you know, Corkers, having run it in 2008, it seems like a lifetime ago. And you're still only 21. But I knew it was important to get those miles under the belt for confidence, because a lot of, you know, any distance race is mental as well as physical. And, you know, even 1,500 metres, Seb Coe would say, the mental part was how you won the race.
Yeah.
So doing something over a course of time of that length, you've got to get your mental side sharp.
And did you do any training on sand before you got to the Sahara?
Yes. So around Hankley Common, there are not amazing places of sand, but ironically, it's, you know, a lot of places where the army train, mm-hmm. and there are big sand hills. There are places where there is sand going through. So, you know, the body knows. And I'll tell you, Corkers, it was interesting. Until I did the race, you step into the unknown. But your body tells you, and I'd never really experienced this before, but all that training that I did made the Marathon des Sables a hell of a lot easier than it could have been. And for some reason, I flew over the sand. I absolutely, we'll come on to it, but that training is absolutely critical. And some of it was sand. Other people went to Lanzarote and trained for months on end in it. I don't think you need to do that. The sand is a mental as well as a physical thing.
Yeah. So well, let's get onto the race. I think it's a really interesting bit here. So, I mean, we're both on regular marathons before, and yeah. you can look at the course, you can position your supporters. Oh, I'll see you at mile 17, I'll see you at mile 6, and you've got little waypoints in your head to go kind of, okay, well, I know that, and you may even know the area, but the Marathon des Sables, very different, isn't it? You don't actually get the course map, the daily stages, until when?
Well, you get it on the bus on the way to from, you land in Oozarat, which is a place where they film Gladiator and all these places, and then you drive 6 hours out into the Sahara, which is, you know, a long old journey when you've waiting for the thing to do, your excitement and levels, and you end up in this place in the middle of nowhere, literally in a basin in the middle of the Sahara, where all of a sudden the tents are out and you're just deposited and you're good to go. So you know, it's a bit of a surreal experience.
I bet. I mean, you got straight to the site, the tents.
Yeah.
And you know, what was that huge colossus in front of you was something called Erg Chebbi.
Exactly. So you had Erg Chebbi. You had the sand dunes that that smile at you because the light plays havoc with you. You know, it's a magical place. Because you've got a day and a half of waiting around, right? You've been given your booklet of the map course.
A day and a half watching. Just looking at the size of these enormous mountains of sand.
They're fucking huge, right? And you look at them and they're some of Africa's largest from what I understand. And you know, a lot of people looked at the course map. I chose not to deliberately mm-hmm. because it was another mental thing. I just wanted to put one foot in front of the other.
Yeah.
It didn't intimidate me at all, but I knew that if it was going to be really hot, if I struggled at all, I needed to make sure that I was comfortable in what was coming. And if all I knew was I had to put one foot in front of the other, it wouldn't be as intimidating as, oh my God, there's something coming that I've never done before.
It's interesting that point in your experience there is when you first really become, I mean, part of a team, part of a tent, aren't you?
Absolutely. You know, tent 110, my band of brothers, all legends, 7 military or ex-military people and a twat from media.
And all you guys were all running for Walking with the Wounded, yeah?
We were running for Walking with the Wounded. We had 3 tents. So yeah. we were lucky in that respect, but none of us had really spent any time with each other.
Okay.
I knew Ed, the founder. He was the sort of leader of the tent. We had a 23-year-old Robbie, who was an officer in the Grenadier Guards. He flew like the wind.
Wow.
We had Mr. Admin, Simon, who used to be in the Coldstream Guards. We had a wonderful guy called Carl Hinnett, who'd run 150 marathons. He was badly burnt in Iraq in the war. And then the two boys, Dunk and Paddy. And Paddy was Dunk. Duncan Slater lost both legs in Afghan and has done some amazing things to prove that it's not the issue that it potentially looks. And Paddy's his best mate. And, you know, it was a very special tent. It was very intimidating to be in a tent with guys with those stories, but also with that military experience.
Yeah.
You know, I had some military experience because my dad shared ration packs in a den in Germany, you know.
So you didn't talk to them? They didn't have any fear about spending a tent a week with someone from media, no?
No, there was no fear of that. Unfortunately, the lunches weren't anywhere near as good as they could have been. And the French decided there was no plants for any beer either. So it was a very difficult and intimidating experience. But, you know, in all seriousness, it was magical and intimidating at the same time. Pretty similar to the race.
Well, I mean, let's talk about the race. Day one, if I remember rightly, was just under marathon distance, about 35K.
That's
and
right.
And about half of that, if not just over half, was very deep sand.
Absolutely. It was
what a hell of a first day.
yeah, you wouldn't. We didn't plan for it. The rumours go round beforehand at the airport. Oh, it's going to be the toughest ever. Every day, every year is, I'm sure. But this was particularly brutal. The sand was everywhere. Mm-hmm. Lots of people were not prepared for it. Normally, on average, a marathon de sable is 10% sand, they say.
Yeah.
I think this year it probably went, it felt like going up to about 35%. And day one was particularly brutal. It knocked out most people, or quite a lot of people. Most people who pulled out, as I understand it, pulled out on day one. It was very hot. Sand was a real issue. They didn't expect it to be as hard as it was. You then throw in, after the sand, you go into a river basin with, you know, gale force winds coming at you with a sandstorm. And you've just done the sand, and you then got more sand to finish. So it was a proper sand dune sandwich that Mr. Bauer presented with us. But, you know, it was probably the best day to have the hardest day.
So this Jack Bauer character, it's worth a mention of. So Patrick Bauer is the founder of the race.
That's right.
And he is, it's fair to say he's a character, yeah?
He's a personality. I believe he used to be a music producer, but importantly, he also used to be in the French Foreign Legion. So, you know, like all music producers, he fancies himself a bit. He likes to perform, particularly for the ladies. But, you know, he's created a wonderful, wonderful race destination. It's, you know, it's legendary. It's he's and him and the logistical staff around it. You know, we were lucky enough to meet him at the airport on the way out. And, you know, he has his critics, I'm sure. But what a fabulous, fabulous experience he has created for lots of people. And, he helps make the experience just that little bit extra.
He does. I mean, I've certainly in 2008, I remember being kind of brought to the start line on the very first day, and then the second, and the third, and the fourth, by a bit of AC/DC. I think the song was "You Shook Me All Night Long." I think you also had a similar experience.
We did. We didn't have. I was shaking all night long just because I couldn't get any bloody sleep. But that's to do with the hardness of the ground and my ineptitude at buying the right sleeping equipment. But we would wake up, you know, music was an important part to a degree in the Marathon des Sables.
Yeah.
You know, I took music with me, but I didn't use it. I only used it when I was struggling,
yeah,
or I needed a lift. You basically, before the start of the race, you read the rules and regulations, the temperature that day. You're rather frustratingly, annoyingly, and highly amusingly, if there are any birthdays in the camp, they just sing "Happy Birthday" and not the Stevie Wonder version. They just forget everyone's name, so it gets a little bit irritating after day two. And then the music really kicks in, the anticipation's there.
And so which one was your track?
We had Highway to Hell by AC/DC, and it is the perfect one. Day one, you're slightly intimidated. Day two, it's like, yeah, bring it on. Day three, bring it on again, and then you kind of through the worst of it. But it, you know, that's one of the magical occasions of the week is listening and knowing that music's coming. Because it gets you going. It properly motivates you to, and it gives you a good start. I mean, if it was, you know, Ness and Dorma or Enya, you'd be in a bit more trouble.
I'm desperate to know about what it felt like. So you've just done this extraordinary first day, which, I mean, does sound epic, and from you know, following it for a few years anyway. How you feel after day one? You got through it. How do you feel after doing near enough a similar thing, but I believe hotter on day two? When you're waking up, what's the process mentally and physically?
Mentally, you're in the unknown night one because you've done it. You feel proud and, you know, strong that you've got the first one out of the way.
Yeah.
But you know that there is more to come. I basically checked off the number of checkpoints there were. How many did I have? I think in total, probably 30 or something like that across the week. And I just counted them down. that was my way of getting through it, because I didn't want to...
Piece by piece, almost.
Yeah, I didn't want to, a bit like Leicester, I didn't want to think the impossible, which was to the finish. And I knew that taking one step at a time, literally, yeah. was the way to get through it. I felt strong. My admin was okay. Yeah. The guys in my tent's admin was sensational. Mine was, you know, needed, I would have been put up for inspection every morning, I'm sure. But you get in, you eat, you talk, you have a good chat. The excitement, the buzz is still there. And then you try and get some sleep.
Day two, you're talking about there's more chance of you turning your ankle.
Yeah, you're looking
at... Which is a race ender.
Tens of miles of, you know, really irritating, frustrating rocks on the desert floor. And you can't do anything about it. You get angry, and you know if you get angry, you're suffering from, you know, dehydration or lack of food. So you have to focus that mind. And you pray for sand. I was praying for sand because I moved so well over it.
You're really not quite right, are you?
Slightly mad. But I was known as the Sandman because... You know, I loved day one. I absolutely loved it because I just flew over the sand. I would just follow people's footprints in the sand, you know, because that was the quickest way up or down. I tucked you in, all within, keep you free from sin, till the Sandman you go. Sleep with one eye open, ripping your pillow tight. Accelerate,
Let's broach water. What management of water? Let's face it, especially day two, day three, the heat has gone through the roof. You know, you mentioned, 40 degrees plus, and with a wind up in the desert, there's no moisture in the air, so you don't even know when you're sweating, because it wicks straight away. What do you do to manage the water?
You know, I had a very good tip from a very good mate of mine. He might be in this room, who said to me, look, you know, you're looking at every 10 minutes. So I took a watch that allowed me to set the alarm every 10 minutes. And it worked an absolute treat, because if you're listening to music, you don't hear it, which is dangerous.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's the biggest withdrawer of people, I believe, the lack of water and dehydration. And we had people in our tent who got dehydrated on several days. So you have to manage your water religiously. You have to drink religiously. You have to manage the checkpoints and your water intake religiously.
Yeah.
And if you've got too much, you either carry more. You know, you carry a loose bottle, it's a pain in the ass, but it's better than not having it. And some people ran out of water. I never ran out of water. It was amazing. I'd run out and then the checkpoint would be there, because, you know, they're not stupid. The organisers, they know they have to put things in place, but you have to manage it yourself. Yeah. They're just giving you the guidelines. I followed the guidelines pretty much to the letter most of the time. And, you know, you also get given about 3,000 salt tablets at the beginning of the race, to your point about dehydration, mm-hmm. and you don't, you know, the sweat and the salt coming out of your body is extreme because of the climate. So what you're doing is every time you finish a bottle, you're putting two salt tablets into your system. Now, you can put too much in. So Ed, the co-founder, found on day one with the sand and the heat that he was really struggling, and he put too much salt in, which made him struggle more.
Yeah.
But most people find a balance and their body tells them yes or no.
What's the balance between it being a personal experience and something you're facing on your own, you know, this extraordinary experience, this amazing challenge, and how much it is to do with the guys back at the tent?
Yes and no. So you'd start the day together, which was always good. And then I think you always had plans maybe to run together with people. I wanted to, you know, we said to Ed at the beginning, you know, I'll run with you. But you find your own pace. And if that pace isn't right for you as it is for someone else, then you just go on and do it on your own. So, and you'll always find friendly people, you know, be they French or Venezuelan or Turkish or, you know, American or whoever. So that in itself is it's a joy, and it's magical to go out in the middle of this place you've never been to before, to walk, run, trek on your own. But you're in a team of 1,250 people who started the race. You're also in a team of your tent.
More of a brotherhood.
Yeah. It's a brotherhood but you're in a team of 30 plus that ran for Walking with the Wounded. But then you're in your own tent team, and then you're on your own.
Yeah.
You know, and that balance shifts all the time. You might meet someone from a tent, your tent, a friend that you've met. you know, I met someone on the plane on the way over there who I hadn't seen in literally 25 years, who used to play rugby at Finchley Rugby Club, and he'd grayed hair and I had less hair, but we instantly recognised each other. So, you know, that brotherhood thing's really important. Everyone is willing to help you if you're in trouble, most of the time. If you're French, you know, might say otherwise, but, you know... And the great thing was that brotherhood, when you got back to the tent, everyone was really pleased. But most importantly, for those late finishers, you knew you had the whole team who ran that race with you. The late runners coming in, those just in front of the camel, you know, our team, whoever was last in, the majority of people would go and find out, you know, would know when they were coming in. So you'd support them. And, you know, that is enormously powerful, whether you're first or last in the tent.
You can't just mention a camel and not explain.
Well, there's yeah, interesting. I saw a few camels in my time, Corkers, but this one was interesting. But basically, there's a camel that follows the race and goes at a very pedestrian 1 mile an hour, and that's literally almost sludging through the desert.
Yeah.
But if you get behind that, you're then eliminated. So literally every day they start off, and you know you'll rush off with the adrenaline, but if you suffer so much or you're going so slow that the camel overtakes you, then it's instant disqualification.
Wow.
And there were a few that almost got there. One in our tent got lost on the long day, and luckily he got in just in time, but it was a close shave.
So, okay, let's talk about the main event, the long day. So every single year in 30 years of this event being on, Mr. Bauer deigns to put on a day four long day. And it's different every year. The course is different every year, but the same constants remain, which are it's bloody long, and it's an overnighter.
Well, the worst part about it is the build up to it. You get past day one and you go, right, well, I've only got 5 days to go. You get past day two, Christ, that long day's coming. Day three is all about managing yourself, ready for the long day.
Yeah.
And, you know, but it's a brutal one. So day three was just as brutal as day one in my eyes. Lots of sand, lots of heat, lots of wind, lots of Jebel action, which you so ably described, you know, on Facebook. So it's all about getting yourself to day four in almost one piece.
And these Jebels are, I mean, they're 100 metres high. They are huge hills, rocky. So, I mean, I think in some places... You mentioned that there was actually guide ropes to drag yourself up at some point.
And you need them. The elevation and the whatever the percentage levels of the hill is ridiculous.
It's like 1 in 12, 1 in 15. Is,
absolutely. And you need it. And you're still carrying your backpack. You've got lots of people in front of you and behind you. And so the pressure's really on. I mean, it's a magical experience, and I love that sort of thing. But you have to remain focused because, you've said it, one turn of your ankle and your race is over. So there were a few times when you slip, but you're... All you're on about is getting to day four in one piece, or, you know, your feet are okay.
Yeah.
And then it's just taking one checkpoint at a time.
Okay, so come on, what's start of the long day?
Yeah.
Now, what's there's something about the start, isn't it? The top 50?
Ah, yes. So they start 3 hours later.
The top 50 runners from the previous three days.
The classification. Yeah. I think it was the top 50 or top 200, either way. Now... which is good because, you know, it gives you a bit more freedom and stuff. So you're racing away, and the stage one was okay. Stage one of the long day was great. It was nice and flat. There was an oasis, for God forbid, a bit of water.
It sounds easy, this.
He plays with you, does Mr. Bauer. He plays with your mind, toys with you like a shark and a seal. he plays with you, and you get one maybe slightly easier stage, and then it all goes wrong. You know, you're looking at Jebels left, right and centre. You're looking at sand dunes on a 1 in 12. You're looking at, you know, rocks that you can't go down or up, let alone, you know, even sort of walk on. So, but, you know, day four, it's 50 miles, 84 kilometres. And it's all about just getting, for me, it was getting to the darkness time, because I knew then it would be cooler. I would feel easier. The body would be better. You know, I might not be able to see as much, but you have a torch and stuff like that. Yeah. So again, it was just managing the stages, get through stage one.
So you've got 2 days though for this, for this. So how do you have a plan? I know a lot of competitors actually, they get the sleeping bag out and kip down at a checkpoint.
No, I'm of the ilk that you just got to finish it. So, you know, I stocked up on the food. I managed my food rather well. I had, you know, my two pockets ready, and I, you know, I talked to you and I talked to others, and I made sure that at every checkpoint, and I ate pretty much on the hour, every hour. I had biltong, which was, as a protein, was absolutely phenomenal. That's why I was called the Sandman, because it just made me superhuman. It really did. No calories, as I understand it, but huge amounts of protein. Gels and stuff like that. And as long as you're managing that as you go through the day, and your salt tablets and your water, all it is about getting to the next, you know, the next checkpoint, which is what I did. And you think, oh, I'm going to have lots of time to pontificate life and look at the stars and, you know, come up with a new billion-dollar business idea. The reality is you're putting one foot in front of another. You're making sure that you're focused. You're getting to the finish of the checkpoint.
So what's going on inside your head then? Are you blank to a degree? You're doing a job?
Or? This is the mental side of it's really strong, because some of it can be really mundane. When it's the desert floor, and you can't see anything but salt pan for miles to come, my God, it's boring. And it's hot and it's frustrating. And when the next French person goes past you and you just want to hit them, or when the Japanese or the Chinese or the Hong Kong ladies go past you and then stop and get in your way, and you just want to protest. But anyway, you know, I'm a polite Englishman, so I just went round them.
I would imagine you're slightly dehydrated as well.
Well, I was, exactly.
Emotions flaring.
The emotions flare, but you just get on with it, don't you? So you have to, that's where the mental toughness comes in on day four more than any other day, because it's long, it can be mundane. You know, my music came out a little bit, but not too much, because you enjoy it. I can look back on it and remember so much more without the music. I knew when I played the music, I remember that, but it was just so much more enjoyable, as someone, you know, Rowley at Mindshare said, don't take any music. I said, well, I'm going to take it, but I'll take it for when I'm feeling bad, because I need that little pick me up.
When I was doing a Facebook updates, is the amount of disbelief about your pace, your race management, how you were holding it together, let alone your feet, your head, going through this long day and through the night. I was getting messages, questions at 1 a.m, 2 a.m, because I mean it was genuine concern. This. You know, I know, you know, like you said, there's certainly a sense of foreboding, I think, not just for your supporters back home, but for all the competitors. So describe, you know, coming to the end.
It's pitch black, but it's, you know, as soon as you hit the cool patch, you turn your torch on, you have a, you know, some sort of illuminous implement that you put in your rucksack for people to see you, and you go for it. And you suddenly get, because it's colder, you suddenly get an air of energy. You know, I felt good. I didn't feel good on some of the desert floor, but I flew through some of it. Mm-hmm. And you follow certain competitors because you get into a rhythm. But I knew at two stages to go. There's one stage before that where you sit in deck chairs and you can have a cup of tea and there's music. And
very civilized.
Very civilized. But you then look at where you've got to go next and you think, shit. And basically it's a steep hill, sand dune, and you've just got to go up it. In the pitch black, and you're thinking, Christ. But it's one foot in front of the other, and I never felt lonely. I felt as if I wanted to just stop and look at the millions of stars in the sky. That was quite a surreal moment, but you know you've got to keep going. I wasn't one of these who'd planned to sleep on the sidelines. I mean, it just wasn't in my makeup. I didn't want to do that. So it was just keeping on going, and I knew that if I kept going, I would get in a reasonable hour. In the end, I got in at, I think it was about 3:30, and the last checkpoint, it took me probably 1 hour and 10 minutes. So 8 kilometres. And I wanted to run, but I think I ran a little bit of it. But I felt super strong. I could have done another 50 miles. I really could, because I'd managed and prepared myself for that moment. So I felt good. And then to your point, you then have the whole of the next day off.
So there's a lovely bunch of happy, jolly people called Doc Trotters, who were the on-site medical team. And I hear you popped along to see them once or twice.
I did, yeah. So my first experience of Doc Trotters, which I thought was some sort of made-up nonsense, and it is actually a doctrotters.com for those interested. Go and visit. They are the most wonderful people on earth, like all good doctors, actually. And, you know, they are there to help with, you know, give you painkillers. I took a couple of painkillers because my feet were sort of blistered. They help you mend blisters. You know, you think you're an expert in blister management when, of course, you're not, because your legs aren't as... I'm not a yoga expert, so it wasn't as easy to reach them. And in all honesty, it's just nice to have a break from the heat of the sun. So I went in there on the longest day, probably twice.
Yeah.
Two sets of painkillers and then two different sets of blister management. One when I forgot to do my bloody sand... sand salopettes up.
Oh, your gaiters, yeah.
My gaiters,
yeah.
That was my own fault. I wondered why I had a blister and a shoe full of sand. But they do a wonderful job. You know, some of them are very pretty, and that's not just the men. And they look after you. There's good banter. Some of them don't speak English, but yeah, you still, you know, get on. And, yeah, you know, they add an extra touch of real personality to a race that can be fairly brutal.
Well, certainly one of the memories that stuck with me from 2008, our tent wasn't too far away from Doc Trotter's. In the middle of the night, you're hearing grown men howl who, yeah, are, you know, chunks of their feet are coming off. And essentially, that was what you were facing every day.
Absolutely. And, you know, I saw some fairly brutal sights in our tent from, you know, the good runners. You know, Robbie, the young officer who was first in the tent every day, one of his blisters was an absolute beauty, and it ballooned into this creation that only, you know, you couldn't imagine.
Is the humour in the tent with these?
All banter. It's, yeah, great banter. Yeah. You know, and you'd
I mean, that's got to help.
You know, you can understand now why being in the army is such a special experience with your sort of band of brothers, as the film goes. But you can understand it because banter gets you through.
I suppose you come out of a day like day four, the double marathon day, and day five, which is the actual marathon 26.2 distance.
Yeah.
And breaking through them, I suppose you haven't really got chance when you get back to camp to be sad, be down, be nervous, because everyone's tearing it out of you.
Completely. And there's really good banter. Your quiet moments when everyone goes to sleep.
Yeah.
When you can think. The other thing that we haven't mentioned is the huge psychological boost you get from the emails that are put in your tent every day.
So how does that work then?
So every day, when you leave, you give your email details to an individual who, yeah, will then say, look, send your messages of support to MIDS or whoever through this. And you get, basically everyone gets given an email update. It goes to your tent and your number.
Mail.
And it's wonderful, right? Who could have thought it? So
it is actually, it's A4 pieces of paper with these messages from friends, family, support.
All over the world.
Incredible.
And it gives you such a psychological boost on day one when you're facing the unknown.
Yeah.
Day two, you know, just because you're in the middle of it. Day three, because you're thinking, Christ, what's coming tomorrow?
Yeah.
And, you know, I think you said it, but to get that level of support on night three,
yeah,
before the big one,
that must be massive.
Read it, a huge emotion, and you know, there was all sorts of wonderful messages across the tent. Actually, it was wonderful to see, and you'd have that, you'd contemplate, you'd probably shed a tear or two,
yeah,
you know, privately, of course, because, yeah, you know, the military don't like to cry. But I was in tears on every evening. You know, the support I got certainly helped me through some of the darker times. That's for sure.
Incredible. And, it's almost part of the recovery, part, yeah, of the preparation.
Absolutely. The recovery and the ritual of starting preparation for the next day.
Yeah.
So you'd have your meal and you'd wait for the email to start or to come yeah, into the tent. And, you know, it was never the same time because that's the French. But, you know, it was enormously powerful. And, you know, I'll never forget each individual in our tent, you know, tent 110 for those who are listening. They, you know, there was an Aussie who was a mate of a mate from, you know, in Australia, who said, look, I did it last year. It's an amazing thing. Just keep going. Don't worry about tomorrow. And I'd never met the guy before, you know, so enormously powerful. And it makes a significant difference to your mental sort of position, if you like. And, you know, it's a great touch.
Incredible. I mean, yeah, by the end, what was it like getting your running in and getting your medal? I mean, I believe Mr. Barr himself gives the medal to every runner.
Yeah, he's on show, he's on parade. The relief you feel when you get to the last checkpoint really struck me. I knew I had 8 kilometres to go.
And that's it.
I was feeling good.
Yeah.
I've got goosebumps talking about it now. I sprinted to the finish. I did 8 kilometres in 45 minutes, right? Which I think is pretty good after however many days in the saddle. There was an Australian called Mark who ran past me. I think he was Special Forces, mm-hmm, or something. He certainly looked it. And I just followed him in.
Is that the first time you have a chance to really totally enjoy?
I think so.
Yeah.
I knew on the long day coming in at 3:30, you enjoy it because it's still cold and, you know, you're just feeling the elation of, I've got to the end of 84 kilometres.
Yeah.
Whereas you've still got 26 miles to go the next day, which, you know, just
one first thing in the morning.
Yeah, one punch after another from Mr. Bauer. But that's the way he rolls. But that, the sheer elation when you come in, it's one of elation, it's one of relief, it's one of quiet satisfaction. And, you know, I looked upstairs at the sky and, you know, it was quite special.
Yeah, I bet. I mean, for all the reasons you were running it for.
Yeah, absolutely. And on my backpack, I had badges of the people who count in my life. And I had my little boy, Monty. I had mum and dad holding Monty. I had mum and dad and, you know, walking with the wounded flag and stuff like that.
Because that's got to help you just keep going.
It's the mental. When you put your bag down and you see your little son smiling at you, you know, he gave me a T-shirt before I went saying, I love you, daddy, and all that sort of stuff. So it's all part and parcel of the mind games that go into something as magical and as brutal as the MDS. You've got to play on the both sides. You've got to feed off that energy, because unless you're a Moroccan goat herder who wins it every year, you're just one of the pack, right? You're one of the brotherhood whose sole aim is to finish it. You know, I wasn't worried about a time. I worried about it afterwards, but that's just because you're competitive.
Of course.
You know.
But, I mean, now, you know, you've been back in the UK for really a matter of days. What's it like to be back after something which is, it's a life changer?
Yeah, absolute life changer. Very surreal. My office were very, very kind. Radium 1, where I work, wonderful group of people who were hugely supportive in the run-up to it, but also afterwards. And, you know, they were following it thanks to your updates and, you know, all that other stuff that you're able to do these days. So it was surreal. It was very proud. It made me a lot more humble, I think, that I'd been able to do something that I know a lot of people who work in the industry and generally who know me thought, he's never going to do that.
Did that help?
Well, there was no way, you know me, there was no way I was not going to finish it. The fact that I finished it with aplomb and a spring in my step gave me a huge amount of pride, knowing that mum and dad were up in the gunner bar in the sky, clinking glasses, going, that's my boy.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's very special. And when you walk around, and I think we talked about this, you don't idly drop it into conversation because it's not what you do.
Yeah.
But to be able to say, if someone says, what's the most magical or brutal thing you've done, that's certainly up there.
I don't know if you've now you've gone through this extraordinary experience with you agree now, but for me, it was like one of the real reasons to feel proud about yourself, which there's actually not that many in life you get a chance to do. I mean, you're lucky with young Monty, but I mean that surely will have an effect on you for a long time.
It's everything and anything. You know, I told you that I'd wanted to do it since I was 16.
Yeah.
I've, you know, with dad, you know, being a very, very good athlete, and mum being clearly, you know, sort of a very proud mother, you know, you put yourself on the line, you commit to something with that purpose of raising money for a very, very, very good charity and a wonderful group of people you share that experience with that you've never met before.
Yeah.
There's something magical in that. It doesn't matter how brutal things get, you will do things together. You will get out of it. You've got to get out of it on your own. But having that support network at all the different levels of, you know, the different onion levels, if you like, of those in the Marathon des Sables with you, but back home, friends, family, you know, and to hear through you and through Facebook afterwards, just how intense that gets and how, you know, people were up till 3 a.m. to see me finish. And you're thinking, Christ, that's a bit serious. But how magical is that?
Yeah,
and, you know, I wish I was on the other side at times just to be, you know, be able to experience it. So you come back, you're delighted to be back, but you feel a bit weird, and I still do. You know, I've spoken to a lot of the guys, and it's a bit of a head fuck. It really is, because you just come back to office life. You know, you come back to work, you come back to a media lunch, or, you know, you come back to whatever it may be. And
so are you one of these Lawrence of Arabia Englishmen who have fallen in love with the desert?
If you manage yourself well, I mean, it would be an amazing experience to, you know, walk across the Sahara. You don't need a couple of locals to probably help you, but I'm not sure about the camels. It's a magical, surreal experience that everyone in life should experience, the desert in all its glory. I had a really, really core purpose in finishing the Marathon du Sable this year, and that is something that kept me going in every single way. Everything I did for a year, I was thinking about that.
Yeah.
And that was not only making Mum, Dad and Monty proud, and myself and my wonderful friends and family and stuff, but it was about raising money. And you put that, if you have a central purpose, they talk about it in business or in sport, you can understand why it's so important. And it certainly helped me put everything in place and get everything in place.
So, walking with the wounded, how many, what's the running total so far?
We're now over £25,000 that I've raised, which is great. I think across the tents for the experience, we're over 250,000.
Bloody hell.
And you know, this is a charity that makes a tremendous difference to the lives of former soldiers, both male and female. They make a tremendous difference both physically and mentally.
Yeah.
So I was running or taking part for their mental health initiative Head Start.
Yeah.
You know, there are thousands of soldiers coming back from Iraq, Afghan and previous conflicts. And, you know, mental health is a serious issue in society anyway. Just imagine you've been through some of it. We've seen the war films, right? It's 500 times worse in reality. Mm. And, you know, you only get to really get under the skin of some of it when you talk to some of the soldiers who've been there.
I won't ask you for your plans for next year yet, because that might come back on me. But congratulations, mate.
Thank you very much.
Unbelievable effort. And I don't just mean from me who understands what you've been through, but from... I mean, the hundreds of people who were following your progress, getting involved, asking how you were, sending you messages. I mean, it was enormous.
Well, thank you. And I'll just take this opportunity to say thank you ever so much to every single person, friends, family, enemies, who have supported me over this journey. And most importantly, you've contributed to a very, very important cause, which, you know, is going to be around for a long, long time, unfortunately, because of the situation we're in. And they need all the support they can get. So thank you and good night.
This podcast was produced by Audioboom.